Andrew Haas is the latest guest in my series of nostalgia interviews. It was a real pleasure to catch up with Andrew when I was in Glasgow in the summer of 2018. Now, Andrew has been at Stirling since 2003. He's originally from Canada, and we talk about the concepts of home and belongingness and being a citizen of the world and the degree to which Andrew is nostalgic for his homeland. He talks about how Scotland is a place that intellectually formed him. He talks about his classic middle-class upbringing. He talks about what his parents did. He talks at length about the role of music and the extent to which popular music evokes memories. We are immediately drawn back to a certain era through the simple listening to a song and how it can bind people together in a way that few other media are able to do. We find out about the influence of jazz and progressive rock and classical music, and Andrew's latest research on the interplay between music, spirituality, and religion and culture. Now, Andrew talks about the concept of superficial nostalgia. We find out why he grew up listening to so much Joni Mitchell, and he found a lyrical and poetic depth there, which is equivalent to the works of the best craftsmen. And we move on to talk about how literature was the pathway into his present discipline, the intersections between English and theology, the importance of interdisciplinarity, and dialogue with musicologists. We learn why those of us who work in religious studies might be said to be on a particular kind of journey. Andrew tells us why belief is irreversible. He tells us about whether he is a looking back or a looking forward person. We talk about the circularity of time and how the present is always impregnated with the past, but that the future is always now. So Andrew talks about the notion of nostalgia as being forward-looking. This was a really great interview to do. It was such a pleasure to catch up with Andrew Haas for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Great. Well, I'm here now with Andrew Haas again in Glasgow as part of my series of interviews in southern Scotland, and great to meet you, rather than in Kent, of course, because we keep bumping into each other when you come down to do external examining or PhD fivering. But you're based at Stirling.
I am.
Yeah. How long have you been here?
I came to Stirling in 2003, having done a PhD in Glasgow in the 90s. So Scotland is really now very much a second residence for me. I grew up in Canada, and my the first 30 years of my life was all things Canadian, West Coast. But I'm now approaching that 30-year mark of being outside of Canada. And so when I say Scotland is a second home, it's obviously our primary home now, but in terms of my overall life, it's really almost matching my formative years.
Yeah, because when I came up here yesterday, although it's still very much summer, I thought it's probably going to be a little bit colder than it was in Kent, so I won't wear my shorts and, you know, I'll put on some long trousers just to be safe. Otherwise, I thought people will think, oh, we know where he's come from, you know, typical southerner. And I thought, hang on a minute, although I've been living in Kent for 13 years, I'm actually Welsh. And so now the fact that I think of myself as a southerner rather than somebody, you know, I was very proud of the fact that I was at Lampeter for many years, does kind of show that I've been in Kent long enough that, and with my children now at a nursery or school in Kent, that I've kind of had to adapt. And probably, you know, if asked the question, where do you come from? That's an interesting one, because home for me has been Kent for not as long as Glasgow has been for you, but certainly long enough for me to sort of recalibrate that whole question of who I am. And the fact that I don't sound very Welsh either kind of means that I could pass more for being Kentish than I could be for being Welsh. So there we are, Canada. I didn't know that. So I guess it was North America, but Canada.
Indeed, and citizen of the world, that common phrase that we use right now, is certainly appropriate in my case, and I think increasingly in so many others' cases, those within academia who move around quite a bit, and the question of identity becomes often a very pressing question. Where do you call home? What nationality are you? And How do you identify yourself in this global context? And it does raise questions about nostalgia, the nostalgia for your homeland, the place of upbringing, the place that formed you in certain respects, but in other respects, I could argue that Scotland is a place that intellectually formed me, having done my doctoral work here and then working out a career principally at the University of Stirling, but within the European context writ large. And so, I'm a hybrid of many different influences and arguably many different sort of nostalgic tendencies of looking back favorably on one era or place or geography over another.
Because I found a few years ago that I'd be at a conference, say in Oxford, or even in one case I was in the Netherlands, and it occurred to me that I knew more people, or to put it another way, more people there knew of my work, knew of my research, than perhaps was the case in my home university, because I've got colleagues from all sorts of humanities-based disciplines, but who don't really know necessarily what my research is on. So you can have a next-door neighbour that you're having to explain that you're working on, I don't know, death and the afterlife, but you can go to a conference and somebody will say, yeah, I read your last book. And you feel a greater sense of home when you're in this almost liminal state of being away at a conference than you do sometimes in your own institution. That's so when you add in the transatlantic element in your case, you must... Yeah, the word, I like the word hybrid that you used.
Yeah. Very much so. It's a common experience, I think.
But you were educated in Canada for your first degree, were you?
First two degrees, that is, post-secondary degrees. And then finally my PhD here in the UK system.
Yeah. And going back a little bit then to your time growing up, what did your parents do? What sort of background did you have? What were the sort of influences on you which... I mean, we can talk about your university education in a second, but in terms of some of those formative influences, what particularly comes to mind? What are the earliest memories that you have?
Well, the earliest memories are those that associated with, I think, a classic middle-class upbringing in North America. In many ways, a very privileged upbringing. We weren't of excessive wealth, but we had means to experience so much of what the rest of the world can't experience. And it was really a life of stability and privilege that I look back, not even with nostalgia now, but with gratitude. Now I have a critical lens on what allowed that middle class to flourish as it did, and there were both positives and negatives, culturally and perhaps sociologically speaking. But in terms of my own personal development, I think I came from a homestead and from a community that really provided stability in so many ways that and allowed me a kind of freedom to work out my own way through the world, both as a young child but also as someone intellectually developing an understanding through academic and various educational levels and phases that I look back and see is very, again, the word privilege comes to mind. I was not from a family where university was a strong legacy. In fact, none of my parents went to university. They were either from English/Scottish stock, or in my father's case, German stock, and immigration was still a big part of the family history, especially on my father's side. University was not a natural place where my parents' generations would go. But I think by the time I got to my generation, it certainly was a place that most of my peers were considering. And though it wasn't my initial intention to work through an undergraduate degree directly out of secondary school, the fact that I eventually went to university was just part of that generation's expectations, you might say, my particular generation's, not my parents. And they were very supportive, again, extremely gracious in how they allowed me to think about my own career and think about the pathways I might want to follow, and ultimately very supportive in whatever pathway I chose.
It's interesting because when I started this interview series, I thought, oh, this is going to be very boring because everyone's going to say, yes, it was inevitable I was going to go to university from the age of five and I was going to be an academic, and that's what my father did before me and my mother did before me, and so on. But that hasn't been the case at all. Almost without exception, I would say that it was a case of nobody else in the family went to university, or in many cases it was perhaps even as a mature student that some of the people I've interviewed decided to go. So their journey has been quite circuitous. But certainly in my case, my sister is also an academic. She's 3 years older than me. It's interesting that we're both first generation university. We both went to the same university in West Wales and stayed there, did our first and, well, you know, PhDs there, and now have careers in academia. So turning the clock back 30 years, inconceivable that's where we would have ended up, because there was no history, no sort of pedigree that would be our legacy, that would be the path that we would follow. But looking back now, it seems almost inevitable that we would have gone down that route, because we jumped through all the hurdles at that time. It was the inevitable thing to do at the age of 18. Of course you're going to put in an application to go to university, because that was the culture of the time back in the late 80s, early 90s. So it sounds like your experience was very similar to that.
Yes, and I think in North America I was the first generation for whom the expectations of university were shifting away from the sort of elite of the cultural contributors to the general idea that if you want a decent job, a certain socioeconomic bracket, if you want to maintain, if not better, the standard of living of your parents, then university is not just an option, but requisite. Now, I'm really at sort of the beginning of that thinking. It took another decade or so where governments began to see the university as drivers of the economy, and therefore want to funnel everybody into university. But I wasn't yet of that generation, so but I was on the cusp of it. So my decision to go to university was really because there's a career there, a white-collar career, that I can find to maintain, if not improve, on the standard of living that I grew up in with my parents. And certainly from North America, my parents, being sort of the 50s generation, that was the expectation. You would better your parents' standard of living, and things would simply grow exponentially through the progress of your economic development, either personally or culturally and nationally, the economic. So this is the whole beginning of the growth economics, etc., etc. The fact that in many ways I went against the grain of that thinking was, I guess, the result of the best you hope for higher education. That in the midst of one motivation, another motivation is created, one that is not necessarily part of your own personal legacy, but you're exposed to ideas and to thinkers and to people that inspire you. And you say, I want to know more about this. I want to dig deeper. And though it took many steps for me personally, I eventually realized that this is a career for me within academia. I certainly did not set out at the outset of my undergraduate degree or even my master's degree to carve out a career in academia.
Was there another route that you might have followed or that you expected to follow, almost not so much as a backup, but as something which maybe you imagined yourself going into if the university route which you did take wasn't available to you?
Yeah, I mean, curiously, I took two-year gap years between every single degree that I had, which prolonged the whole process, of course. But I did not go immediately out of high school. I had 2 years of working and thinking of what I'd like to do. And this was in the early 80s when there were certain economic depressions that were not opening doors, I would have hoped. And university then became, well, if I can't do this, I might as well go to university. I know I can do the work. Let's see what transpires there. And then I went in the undergraduate degree into something that would have been similar to my own father's world was the world of construction. He was an electrical contractor, and so I began by thinking of a career perhaps in either engineering or architecture, like that. It soon became clear that my skills were not in the theoretical side of engineering. And UBC, where I went at the time, required an engineering degree for architecture. So that wasn't something I pursued for very long. But that was the initial motivation. And then another 2 years after my undergraduate, before I went into a master's, and then another 2 years of gap before I did my PhD. All the time, trying to sort through, is this a career for me? What would I really gain with a master's? What could I do with it professionally? Took a lot of consideration and even soul-searching. And the big step, of course, was the doctoral one, where you had to say, well, if I do this step, I'm really committing myself to a scholarly career. But again, it was the gap years that allowed me this kind of fallow space to think through very circumspectly whether that...
You see, I didn't really do that because although I always assumed when I was young that if I could follow a dream, it would be something in radio, but there was no legacy there. There was nothing in my family, for example, that meant that, you know, I didn't have anybody who had experience of working in broadcasting. It was just something that I like listening to the radio, and I thought, oh, I could do something like that when I'm older. But my dad worked on the railways, and it was wonderful because we used to have free train travel. Maybe I should be very careful what I say there, because, you know, I had wonderful opportunities. I could travel anywhere in the country. We could even go to the Isle of Wight, and we could have gone to the Isle of Man or Jersey without having to pay because of my dad's profession. And even until I finished university, I was in my 20s, I was still able to visit friends sometimes around the country and not have to pay for the privilege. So there was probably a part of me when I was very young that imagined something to do with the railways was something that I might end up doing. And yet, when I went to university, everything just sort of fell into place. And lecturers would say to me sometimes, well, yes, you know, you're doing quite well, so have you considered doing a master's or have you considered doing a PhD? And I thought, that's what I'm going to do. But because there was nothing, there was no plan B, it was more that I had the qualifications in an academic context. So it seemed almost inevitable that provided I was able to get the financial support, which I was able to do from my family, and they were very generous, then that was something that I was able to pursue. I have no regrets about what I did, but it's interesting that I didn't do the soul searching. For me, there was almost the worry that if I'd had to go into the inverted commas the real world and, you know, and get a more regular job outside of being, as I was then, a student, you know, I didn't know what I would do. And I think it was the fear of the unknown that also made me think, well, you know, what am I good at? I'm capable of writing essays and obtaining qualifications, you know, bachelor's, master's, and then PhD. So it just seemed inevitable that I would end up applying for jobs in this sector. Again, no regrets about what I've done. But it's interesting that it just fell into place because it was almost a fear of doing what the students these days do all the time, which is have regular jobs. They work in bars, they work in supermarkets. Mm-hmm. They may not get paid very much for it, but wonderful life skills. So I kind of feel that those extra sort of skills, I'm almost like learning while having a very wonderful, you know, comfortable career as an academic. But I suspect, well, I don't know what the future has in store, but it's interesting that that I never really thought through, you know, what plan B might be.
And yet one of your early fascinations is now manifesting itself in this very form of a podcast.
Yes.
This is you doing your radio thing these many years later.
Because I never lost that dream. And it was always there, but I didn't know how to channel it. It was more a case, well, I can't, you know, you can't go from being a university lecturer to doing a radio show. Although recently I thought, but why not? Because this is my radio show. Mm. You know, there may be a real radio show that comes of it in the future. It actually doesn't matter. This is where I am now, and it's leading me somewhere that I want to go. But it's interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That you're not the only person I've interviewed as well who has talked about having a family member who has done something very practical, something in, you know, in technology or something in industry, and there might have been an expectation that they would follow that path, but took something very different, and perhaps their own children have then, you know, followed an academic route as well. So, you know, the decisions we make have huge consequences for our immediate family and indeed for posterity. And I'm very mindful of that, especially as I've got quite young children. But what about other influences? So when you were at university, one of the questions that I've been asking other interviewees are, what were you into musically, for example? I mean, one of my obsessions, relevant to what we were just talking about, was the charts. What were the sounds at the time? I can almost go back and say, yes, you know, growing up in, you know, when I was 18, 1981, this is the sort of thing I was listening to. I can think of all sorts of historic events and personal events in the context of what I was listening to on the radio at the time. Was that the case for you growing up in Canada?
Well, you couldn't avoid that. One of the prevailing features of popular music, especially all music, but popular music especially, is this uncanny ability to evoke memories in such a way that we are almost immediately drawn back to a certain era, a certain moment even, through the listening of a song, a simple song. And why popular music is true to its name, popular, is it's got that inbred ability to keep people constantly referring back to their own histories and their own pasts. And, you know, we see this much more in North America, where the music has become demographically categorized now. So with radio stations all across North America, for decades, you know, exclusively for decades, turn this radio station on if you want the 70s or the 60s or the 80s or the 90s. Occasionally you'll get some that mix across. Now, you couldn't avoid that. You know, you were growing up in my case as a child and teenager in the 70s, you know, a period where popular music was ubiquitous everywhere you went, and it just became part of your DNA. And music was something that was as social as it was personal. And again, that's one of the great features of popular music, is it binds people together in a way that few other medium do. So, who growing up in that period, or even anywhere since arguably the 50s or 60s, can say music wasn't an important part of their life? It certainly was. In my case, I can perhaps even exaggerate that, because music became a real central part of my experience by virtue of the secondary school that I went to, which had an extremely well-developed music program, and through my own upbringing in the church that we went to, that had a very strong musical side as well, I was able to bring those two together within the secondary context and develop a real love of music as both a listener and a player. So I play various instruments in various different genres. It was in the high school jazz band, though, that the world of jazz was opened up to me in a very powerful way. And it soon, by the time I was reaching my late teens, it soon began to eclipse all other forms of music as the principal inspiring form of music for me. And as I tried to develop that in my own musical skills and expanded my listening to it, jazz became an extremely formative part of my young life, my young adulthood. I went through various phases of music, as most people do. The charts was inevitable as a 12, 14-year-old. I then was turned onto progressive rock music of the late 70s by various people. That married nicely with jazz eventually because of the technical proficiency that was required for both, although they're very different sensibilities. And classical music was a kind of substratum through all of that because my parents were exposing us constantly to the classical traditions, including opera. In fact, my mother was a part of an opera chorus that needed extras for one production, and I was able to be an extra in in several operas, actually, which opened up again a whole other world of musicality for me. So music was such an important part of my life that I have never really strayed from its original inspirations. And now I can say things have sort of come full circle because my latest project academically, which is occupying the entirety of my year-long research right now, is centered on music. And I'm looking at the relationship between music, spirituality, and religion and culture in the way things have evolved over the last 50 years or so. So, absolutely central to who and what I am. I think my interest in popular music was continually being reassessed all the time. As I found other forms of music that satisfied me more, that allowed me to deepen my engagement with it. And I became increasingly uncomfortable with the commercialized side of music. Which, of course, is now impossible to avoid at any level and in any genre. Even the most arcane classical music is commercialized to some extent. Put anything on a recording device, it's now in the commercial domain. Mm-hmm. Whether money is transacted or not, it's in a commercial domain. Mm-hmm. And, of course, everything is recorded in some way, shape, or form. So we live in interesting times around the question of music. The real nostalgic side of music, I still sort of link with popular music in some way. But for me, that stays on a more superficial level. I wouldn't suggest that is the case for everybody. Not at all. Other people have very profound experiences with popular music. But for me, it was a much more of a kind of superficial nostalgia. Ah, yes, that song evokes the time where I remember walking to school with X, and I did this, and we developed a whole routine around the lyrics. You know, we would sing them to each other and spoof them, or, you know, whatever. All that kind of opens up that way. But when I first encountered a serious jazz musician, and by serious I mean someone whose music was really intently trying to get into the very depths of their soul, or when I encountered a Beethoven symphony or something like that, another level opened up that was not available for me at the popular level. And in many ways, I've been exploring the depths that those various genres can still open up. Some no longer have that depth, even in jazz and classical. Other popular forms have shown a depth that I first missed. So it's funny, as we move through life, music takes different shapes and I remember your different phases of your life.
Yeah, because I remember the debate in 1992 when Classic FM started in this country, and it was felt at the time that because this was a program that was effectively classical music being treated as pop music, you know, you'd have the 3 or 4 minute excerpts from symphonies, you wouldn't have the full works that Radio 3 would pride themselves on. And it was thought that it was going to be part of the dumbing down of high culture. And whether that has or hasn't happened, there is an audience for Classic FM. And in the same way that with pirate radio in the 1960s, that now, you know, at the time it was obviously, well, I mean, it led to some very creative talents, you know, Kenny Everett, for example, John Peel, Tony Blackburn. But it's interesting how sometimes, as in my case, that music, which I was almost a little bit embarrassed about, when I would never, for example, talk to my university lecturers when I was an undergraduate about some of the music I listened to or the radio programs, because I was worried that they might think that was very sort of low culture. There was an expectation that, you know, back then the people who were teaching me seemed very highbrow in their tastes, whereas the students I teach now are fully aware that, you know, I watch Christmas movies, and of course I've written books, you know, based on that. But for me, I think it's the juxtaposition, really, between having the interest in popular culture, but with the academic, almost the conceptualizing, the methodologies, which I've got from a different context through scholarly study, that I'm now at a place where I can bring those together and see if there is some sort of, you know, wider question about what is religious music, you know, what is the relationship mm-hmm. between the religious mm-hmm. and the secular, mm-hmm. which I couldn't have done before. So, but I kind of feel that I've jumped from A to C and missed out B in the process.
B being?
Well, if A is the popular music and C is the academic study, it almost feels that the B would be the point in between, that maybe it would be, for me, the jazz, or it would be the classical music. I've gone from popular music to an academic study of popular music, right. But I've missed out the... It's like with... I mean, I looked at biblical films as part of my PhD. I looked at a lot of Martin Scorsese, and I did look at The Last Temptation of Christ, and I looked at The Greatest Story Ever Told, but they came later, and it was through a study of Taxi Driver and Cape Fear and Raging Bull that I got to those classics. Right. That might not be readily apparent from reading my screen Christologies, but when I was talking to my supervisor at the beginning, I thought, well, do I have to look at The Last Temptation of Christ? And I realised that I probably did, but it was interesting that was the obvious... Well, people would stop me on the bus sometimes and say, when I said I was looking at religion and film, they'd say, which biblical epics are you looking at? And it's like, well, hang on, you've made an assumption about what I'm looking at. But that was a very obvious one, and it was precisely because it was so obvious that I was determined to chart a different course.
Mm, yeah. I think it's very interesting to see how your own life, as it evolves, comes back to these genres and these experiences of your younger years, not necessarily youth, but even your middle years, And you come at them differently, either through a different kind of appreciation or a lens that wasn't available to you back, you know, in your case, an academic lens that, you know, come to these things differently. Or in the case, you know, life experience just opens up avenues of engagement that were not available at a particular time. And I think music's a fascinating study in that respect. I grew up in Canada where they had a radio station called Easy Listening Music. And my mother would default to that, to the chagrin of the rest of the children, because of just the hurly-burly of life. I understand now why Easy Listening Music would have been attracted to my mother, because when there's chaos and tumult all around you, you know, the calming effect of music can be necessary, absolutely requisite to your sanity. And this particular radio station, as a result of a certain government policy, had a Canadian content requirement. So X percentage of all music that they played had to have Canadian artists. So Joni Mitchell was played all the time. And current Joni Mitchell, not just old Joni, but the current Joni. So I grew up with all these Joni Mitchell tunes and associated that with easy listening parental music. And never thought that that'd be anything I could ever countenance. Well, you know, you grow up, you have your own children, you encounter Joni Mitchell at a completely different stage of life, mm-hmm. and suddenly you realize, A, it's not necessarily easy listening, right. but B, there's something there that as a youth completely passed me by, a lyrical depth, a poetic depth that, you know, now I would rate with some of the great craftspeople of all time, but it's just something unavailable to me in my youth. Mm. Whereas, you know, I was taken by, you know, the bombast of Tchaikovsky's 1812th Overture when I was a 14-year-old. Oh, cannons, you know. Now you listen to that and it is bombast, you know. It's got, you know, nothing that touches any of my experiences now. So it's curious how things can invert.
I'm also thinking of a film like Clockwork Orange, where the use of classical music in a young punk, somebody a complete nihilist, somebody who's intent on destruction, he actually sort of reflects on, you know, the classical greats, mm-hmm. and that goes slightly against the grain of what you might expect, and that's but the way in which maybe he's also faking it, we don't know, but it's interesting that it's the use of classical music in that context which kind of goes against the grain of what somebody of his generation was, the Dwoog, is it, or the Droog, that, you know, that young Alex is supposed to represent. But when you mentioned Joni Mitchell and the different sort of layers of meaning, I was thinking, yes, so you could literally look at life from both sides now. Had to get that in. But I think the way that almost unexpectedly you can be listening to something and just think, you know, maybe it's by pure accident. You know, I used to find this on the radio sometimes, that music would be played, and it might be because you had a presenter like John Peel over here who would really champion bands that were not part of the mainstream playlist, and occasionally that would enter the mainstream. And it got to the point almost then that only a few years before John Peel died, he, who was, you know, for years prided himself on being, you know, the great sort of, you know, champion of indie music, was given a chance to present the top 40 on Radio 1 one Sunday evening, because it was thought that quite a few of the acts in that top 40 were, you know, from musicians that Peel would have played on his program, and that certainly wasn't the case, for example, in the 1980s, mm-hmm. When pop music then, you know, was really quite youth oriented, mm-hmm. and quite sort of Stockick and Waterman type oriented. But how did you get from that then to academia? In terms of what you decided to study, where did you go? What was was it the study of religion that you undertook for your first degree?
It was not. Having started out in a more science-based curriculum with the intentions of something very pragmatic, I found that my own strengths and skills tended more towards the humanities. And as is often the case, teachers play a crucial role in your decision-making. And in this case, it was a teacher who I never took ever one class with, and he just happened to be my next-door neighbor. And he had come back to the family home that he grew up in, and so he was a good 10, 12 years older than me, so we never connected as children, but he at some point moved back to the family home when he was just starting out as an academic, and he happened to be teaching at UBC in the English department. And it was through several very long and personal conversations with that neighbor where he was able to convince me that English was a great pathway to follow in the humanities degree. And I'll never forget the phrase that really convinced me. He says, "What English literature can do and should do is open you up to the greatest minds that have ever thought." And I'd never conceived of literature in that way. Literature to me was always something of just pure creativity, much as a musician picks up an instrument and produces a tune. A literary figure does the same thing with a pen or what have you. This idea that the greatest minds are suddenly opened up to me was such an attraction that I eventually pursued, with his encouragement and steer, an undergraduate degree in English literature. Because of my own particular religious background, I was partial to literatures that had some kind of religious content, and I remember one course being in the religion in the Bible as literature, and that was very formative as well. What I thought I could do with this degree, what my parents thought I could do with this degree, was a complete mystery. But it was something that impassioned me, and it was something that captured my imagination on multiple levels, and something that also received affirmation from other figures along the way. I think if it's a single individual, and that's your only source of support or confirmation, it may not root itself. But my life was quite extensive in its social network, and I met people who were very impassioned by literature in other ways, and it was through that combination of teachers and fellow peers that the literary world became one that I felt I wanted to look in more intently. And so I quite happily did an undergraduate.
And you wouldn't be alone in that. Certainly one of my colleagues, Yvonne Sherwood at Kent, did her first degree in literature. And it was only at doctoral level that she was looking at the Bible as literature, and then found herself in a department of religious studies. So that trajectory is actually a very familiar one. In that sense, of course, it means that you've got a huge sort of frame of reference. So when you're looking at the study of religion, you can bring in the way I mean, certainly when I was studying, I was very conscious of a lot of 19th century work. The Victorian Crisis of Faith came quite heavily into my work at one point. I remember reading George Eliot, for example. And that's an area that I did pursue, actually, as an undergraduate module. But I had a lot of friends who were doing English for their degree, and there were clear intersections. And part of me wished that I could have explored that avenue a little bit further, but... at the same time, though, a lot of my friends who were doing English for their degree used to find that by the time they'd worked their way through all the various novels they had to read each week, they didn't have much chance to go on to the secondary sources. Whereas in my subject, a lot of the stuff I was looking at was secondary sources. I was looking at, you know, whatever the subject was. If I was looking at a particular theologian, I might look at Bultmann's work on myth, but I'd also be looking at a lot of secondary literature, and I'd be according as much emphasis to people who were writing on Bultmann as on Bultmann himself. And in a way, I felt that at least I was getting through a wider range of material, because a lot of my friends doing English found that because they were required to read from cover to cover particular novels, in a way that they had a different sense of how they were able to apportion their time. Mm-hmm. So for me, I was very conscious that I was doing my degree in a very different sort of way, but which suited me, of sort of working my way through various works without necessarily reading everything from cover to cover, because strategically, if you've got 2 weeks to write an essay, you may not have the time to read a 600,000 word novel, much as I might like to do that.
Indeed. And I do remember coming up against tight deadlines and still having only halfway through a Dickens novel.
Well, I had a friend who was quite upset once that he got a low mark. I don't know what mark he got. I think it was in the 50s. And he wrote on Darwin. And he said he'd spent the whole of the Christmas holidays reading On the Origin of Species. And he said how awful it was that no one else in the class had read that. And he'd got this low mark, and he thought, but, you know, shouldn't I get credit, he thought, for reading, Darwin's primary work. And I said, well, you know, what else did you look at? And he said, oh, I didn't have time to read anything else. And I thought, well, you know, therein lies the issue. Yeah. So part of me thought... he was right on one level. There was a certain integrity in what he did, but also a degree requires you to be strategic at the same time. Yeah. And so I know I did the right degree for me, which was theology, but I was very attracted to some of the text that a lot of my literary friends were looking at, but in my case also quite glad that I didn't have what I would have seen as the chore of reading an entire novel, which I knew I would have really struggled to get through in a week or two, particularly when that was, you know, one essay among many that needed to be worked on simultaneously.
Well, in my case, I did go on to do a theology degree proper as well, at the master's level, and that was a 2-year master's degree. But that course allowed me to integrate a lot of my literary interests and growing interests at that time. So that had a very interdisciplinary approach that I carried through then into my doctoral degree, which by the time I'd figured out this is what I want to do, and then by the time I'd figured out where I wanted to do it, I found myself formally placed in two camps. The University of Glasgow had a centre that was partly sponsored by the English department and partly by the Divinity faculty at the time. And so I was bringing my undergraduate and my master's degree into confluence within the doctoral program in a very formal way. And ever since, I've been working in that interdisciplinary space unapologetically, in ways that have kept me, I think, going through the various rigors of scholarly life and academic life that can impose all sorts of different obstacles. But I think it's the interdisciplinary side that keeps things fresh.
I think it's that sort of dialectic that can make a PhD incredibly diverse, because in my case I'd studied eschatology, life after death, as part of my master's degree, But then I was looking at film for my PhD, and then a few years later, I wrote a book on eschatology and film. So it was sort of bringing together my master's and my PhD study, and then I now teach a course on death and the afterlife. And I'm very aware that I'm in debt to some of my own teachers as an undergraduate who were teaching me in this area. But then I'm bringing in the filmic angle, which was unheard of, you know, in the early 90s. You wouldn't have had a course on religion and film. And so I was able to sort of, in a way, I was able to sort of properly honour the work of some very inspiring teachers when I was at Lampeter, but I was able to put my own twist on it, which made it a little bit more distinctive. So I felt that I was doing something that I wasn't just regurgitating stuff that I'd been taught 20 years earlier. But to an extent, without that basis as an undergraduate, I don't think I'd have been able to teach properly in this area, in the same way that I sometimes have students taking my religion and film course as a wild module. And if they haven't done any other religious studies modules, they sometimes get a bit unstuck, because I sometimes have students who say, well, I've never done a module in religious studies before, but I'm a Christian and I like watching film. And I see their essays and I realise that there are lots of gaps in what they're writing, because although it's great to be passionate about film, the module that I teach has a very strong theology or religious studies undergirding, and I think some of the students who take that don't necessarily see that, and then find that there are a lot of gaps which some of the other students have managed to fill. So again, I think it's important to be able to bring together some very discrete areas, but you can only do that once you understand. It's like doing a joint honours degree, isn't it? You need to know the methodologies mm-hmm. for both subjects before you can properly call yourself an expert mm-hmm. and have the necessary skill set to move forward. So it sounds like you've managed, and in terms of what you're doing now with music, again, a great interdisciplinary study, which I'm guessing can see a coalescence of all of those wider background interests.
Absolutely. I think there's a tendency to look back on those early years of interdisciplinary encouragement I received as sort of through a nostalgic lens. We have a lot of rhetoric of interdisciplinarity now, but there's a lot of obstacles and roadblocks put up for someone in today's academic environment to pursue a truly interdisciplinary agenda. And there are consequences for that. It's very difficult for marketing purposes to see yourself and present your profile in a purely interdisciplinary way. Universities want that on the one hand, but you know, when it comes to other practices, hiring practices, you know, publishing practices, etc., there is still this really entrenched idea about what a scholar ought to be doing, and it ought to be in a very narrow expertise. So the person who's deliberately sort of breaking down disciplinary barriers always runs the risk of being someone who cannot claim the same kind of rigorous expertise as the true disciplinarian. And dilettantism and that has always been a charge that goes along with interdisciplinary work. Again, I don't think I would have stayed in the business if I had to become the narrow disciplinarian of a niche little pocket of scholarly work. My interests have always been expansive, and as I said earlier, I've come full circle in a way that is trying to open up that expanse now to something that, you know, in terms of scholarship, I can't claim the expertise of a musicologist, but I think I can contribute something to that field which the musicologist mm-hmm. can't. And I hope, anyways, that dialogue with the musicologist can open up spaces that neither of us knew existed before.
And I think it's quite similar to when a student of mine might want to go into law and they need to do a law conversion course. But although they're conscious that they're going into a profession where their first degree is not in law, having a degree in religious studies can be an asset, because if you've got 30 people going for a job or 30 people in a law firm, one of whom has a degree in religious studies and then the other 29 in law, well, that person with religious studies can take on particular cases I would have thought that the other 29 might not be so inclined to take. So you can turn that to your advantage, which, yes, is, which sounds like, you know, yeah, very much what you're referring to.
Yes. Yes, I think that's right.
A few more philosophically based questions just to wrap up, because you've touched on nostalgia quite a few times in our discussion so far. But would you say that your memories going back, and it might be, you know, childhood or university or your subsequent career, are predominantly positive? I mean, I ask that question because this whole thing about nostalgia is, are we looking at the past through a rose-coloured lens? Or maybe sometimes it's bittersweet experiences that make us reflective and make us, in some cases, more inclined to pine for something, you know, that something maybe didn't seem right at the time, or there may be things from our past that we didn't get right, maybe we want to sort of go back and correct those. And I just wondered whether, when you look back, there is a sense in which you can sort of say, well, you know, whether things were great or not, there's a sense in which you kind of feel a certain predilection towards them, perhaps because they weren't as rose-coloured as some of the caricatures of nostalgia tend to suggest.
So that's a very fascinating question, because I think those of us who work within religious studies are on a particular kind of journey that necessarily, I would argue, disrupts the kinds of presuppositions and the inherited views and perspectives that may have been part of our early development and formation. You can't study the world of religion, or even in the more constricted world of theology, without those thoughts being exercised. They don't have to be jettisoned. Sometimes they are, but they don't have to be. But they're never the same. And it's of a particular kind of development that, when you look back on it, you look back on it with the acknowledgement that you can never reverse it. And belief is a very bizarre phenomenon in that sense. If you have a belief, and the belief shifts or changes, however nuanced in manner or however dramatic in manner, that shift is irreversible. You know, to take a very crude example, the moment a child becomes aware of sexuality, you can't then go to that child and say, oh, by the way, it was just a joke. It was all a bit of hogwash. None of that's true. You can't do that. The moment you become aware of it, emotionally, physically, you know, with your hormones shifting, but just as significantly within your whole sense of mind and being, it's irreversible. And I think belief is very similar in that way. The moment that you shift in your perspective on something, you just can't go back and reverse it. So to answer your question, I think if you have been on a journey of development, both in terms of your own personal theology and in the way that you engage with your heritage, in my case, a Western Christian heritage, and you see different strands of it that at the time would have been, you know, perfectly acceptable, perhaps naively so or innocently so, you can't then just go back and shift and change that. So I don't look back on those early ideas and thoughts and experiences with a certain rose-colored lens. I know if I would do that, that would be a contrivance on my part, and it wouldn't be, it would lose an integrity. But I do look back on those early years with, I think, a sense of gratitude. The ideas and thoughts that help develop who I am today, though I might not embrace fully, sometimes not at all anymore, sometimes with a deep critical lens, they still were so powerfully influential of who I am today that I only look back with a sense of gratitude. Not, I wouldn't call that nostalgia. I would call that a sense of gratitude. Even if I can't go back to it and wouldn't choose to go back to it in any way.
Mm. And I think sometimes those experiences that we are nostalgic about are just that, because there was a challenge that we managed to overcome. And it wasn't a case of thinking, oh, wasn't life wonderful? I mean, I can't think of any period in my life when I could say, oh, there were no tensions, there were no conflicts, there were nothing to worry about. But it's how you respond to a situation that almost is the golden age. It's sort of like, here's the obstacle, but wow, rather than avoid it, I stared it in the face. It might be on a pedestrian level, it might be an essay deadline. You simply say, okay, I've got to write this number of words by next Thursday. In achieving that goal, that sense of exhilaration, that sense of having surmounted an obstacle, you can look back and say, yeah, I had the confidence, the wherewithal to do that. Whereas a time when you can think, yeah, I didn't have any essays to write, or I can't think of any period in my life where I could say that I didn't have anything to worry about. Because if there was nothing to worry about, that in itself would be grounds to be pretty worrying. Because you know, I can't think of any period in life when there isn't, whether it's a gas bill that needs to be paid, or a trip to the dentist, or a lecture that has to be prepared. And that's why I'm ostensibly on holiday at the moment. But for me, the most perfect holiday means catching up, reconnecting with friends and colleagues, and interviewing them. Yeah. That for me, it's called the busman's holiday, isn't it? But if I wasn't doing this, what would I be doing? Would I be sitting in a bar having a few drinks? You know, I mean, I can do that anyway, but it doesn't have to be an either or.
Yeah.
We all have our comfort zones.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not the sort of person who could just lie on a beach. I'd be lying on a beach thinking, well, I should be checking my email. It's just me.
Yeah.
Final question. Would you consider yourself then, I think you have answered this, but a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I think I would have to say, in general, I'm a looking forward person. But I would have to qualify that, as all good academics are trained to do. Of course, what hasn't emerged in our conversation but is very much part of my own development is an increasing engagement with philosophy and philosophical key thinkers as part of the history of ideas of the West. And I devote more and more of my time to reading philosophy and engaging at the philosophical level. And for me, the philosopher's task is always to see things 200 years ahead in the future. Making thoughts and decisions and ruminations that take into account where will that land us 200 years from now. I've heard philosophers vary on the chronology here. Some say 100 years. I've heard someone say 400 years. And perhaps stand behind that is a certain philosophical position about how we develop as human beings, and that we can actually think with the effect of coming to fruition 200 years from now. But I still very much hold to that perspective, that what I am engaged with now in my thinking and my writing needs to have that 200-year view. And here's the qualification. In order to do that, I have to go back in my history to understand how the next 200 years could look. And so there's that circularity of time that is very much part of my thinking. The present is always impregnated with the past, but the future is always now in some respect for me. So if nostalgia is going to figure, it's got to figure in a bidirectional way. Nostalgia has to go forward as much as it goes back. And if I am thinking about a 200-year set of circumstances or conditions for my progeny, I have to think about that in certain positive and hopeful ways. And you can call that a kind of forward-looking nostalgia.
Not only the most perfect answer, but you can bet I'm going to be quoting you in my next monograph. Andrew Hess, thank you very much.
Thank you.